Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Let's see, we are in paper 86, section 5. We got into the section a little ways. It's on old single column, page 954. And we're on... if you have it numbered by paragraph, you know, properly speaking, it's paragraph 6. Or if you have it, your book is numbered by item, it's item number 10. It's that paragraph kind of in the middle of the section that starts with early in evolution. Right after that little list there. A couple paragraphs after that little list. Okay, so... remember this section is entitled the Ghost Soul Concept. They were getting us going on thinking about the genesis and early development of the ghost cult, so that you don't just have various more amorphous animistic sorts of thoughts, but beginning with the mystery of death, combined with the mysteriousness of dream life, a rationalization scheme begins to form. That there's and everyone begins to believe that there's a whole nother world, if you will, a whole nother domain besides that which is immediately apparent. A ghost land, and the ghost being initially thought in very simple terms is just what's left of you after you die and you take the body away. And remember, they were thinking it was probably the breath that was this quote unquote soul that was the not body thing. And that, it's those breaths, those ghosts that are doing things in your dreams. We need to just keep going on that. They'll finish developing the basics here, and then the next paper goes into the ghost cult in great detail. Because it's super important to recognize that other than the very, very primitive animistic stuff that still floats around with all of us, every concept that everyone has of God and spirit beings and everything is all built upon those initial concepts of ghosts and what ghosts were up to and what your relationship to ghosts is, and why that's significant, etc. So that God, in the bottom-up sense of using that word God, is just nothing but the sort of final exaltation of the ghost notion. It's appropriate that it begins with the letter G as well. Because really it is just a contraction, if you will, of that ghost concept. Like I said, they're going to give us a little bit more explaining the last stuff we just read there in that list. Remember, they're talking about how you have the whole spectrum from fainting to death and how that's talking about what relationship the soul is relative to the body with all of that and worrying about the soul escaping when you sneeze and saying God bless you and all that. That's what we just read. So what else do they say here?
Early in evolution, sleep was regarded as proving that the ghost soul could be absent from the body, and it was believed that it could be called back by speaking or shouting the sleeper's name. In other forms of unconsciousness, the soul was thought to be farther away, perhaps trying to escape for good, impending death. Dreams were looked upon as the experiences of the soul during sleep while temporarily absent from the body. The savage believes his dreams to be just as real as any part of his waking experience. The ancients made a practice of awakening sleepers gradually so that the soul might have time to get back into the body.
Right. And, you know, and even if we're not literally thinking that we have to do it gradually to get soul back in the body, you'll still have someone with the idea of having some waking mechanism that wakes you gradually. I mean, once you start a thought like that, it gets re-rationalized, but the basic thing goes on forever. You know, when they said the savage believes his dreams to be just as real, you know, just as much literally a part of the objective external world, in other words, just as real as any part of his waking experience. Now, that's why sleep was regarded as proving that the ghost soul could be absent from the body. Right? So until you question that assumption, right, you've got everything that inescapably rationally follows suit from that initial assumption. You know, and as we talk about all the time, the Urantia book is first and foremost trying to get you to walk back through all your lines of rationalization to those initial assumptions and either reconsider them or, in most cases, consider them for the first time. To note that you have this assumption that you've never even thought about the fact that you have and that everything you think is predicated on it. And, oh my goodness, what would happen if you changed that initial assumption? Would all of your conclusions change? Probably. you know, and if that's scary, you know, this is not the book for you. This is the book for people who aren't afraid of that consequence, of having all of the conclusions change. Okay, so the like I said, see, they're giving you a little bit of that physics of, like I said, I mean, they're just thinking about it very simply, that the more profound the lack of normal animation, the farther the soul must be from the body. And, you know, when you, maybe just a quick little aside, if you go to people trying to rationalize a near-death experience today, right, don't be surprised if they're still in this old wineskin trying to rationalize it. Well, that's got to be my soul that just went somewhere and came back. No, it's not that. It never was that. Didn't matter if you were coma or whatever, right? If there was something that actually went and came back, it wasn't your soul. It was your adjuster. It wasn't you. It was your adjuster. It's like, well, how do I know about it then? Well, because the adjuster comes back and plugs in, and you'll get a little flash when it plugs back in. And you don't know you have an adjuster that's a totally separate self. So you'll think those are your memories. You know, not to mention, of course, you know, when it plugs in and you get a little flash of its memories, you don't really get its memories. You get its memories reprocessed into your worldview, because your framework can't hold its memories directly, right? And so its memories get completely reworked into something that makes sense to you. You know, everything you saw, everything you smelled, everything, yeah, you know, all of it has been completely reprocessed from what it actually experienced so that it fits into your framework. Yeah, and if you assume anything but what I just said, you're going off, you know, on an illusory tangent. That's just the physics of it. If you could engage in basically undistorted form a memory of your adjuster, you would be fused to your adjuster. Yeah. And your body wouldn't be sitting in front of me. Yeah, it's just the fact of it.
And you wouldn't be reconnecting.
Right. And you wouldn't have been leaving and reconnecting in the first place. Right. There are experiences, in the, going beyond dreams. That was why I bothered to kind of go off on that tangent. There's experiences beyond just dreams that you could further think are proof that this tried and tested system of understanding is valid. Further proof. But again, all that proof is dependent upon your initial assumptions and your mind frame and et cetera. Appearances don't imply reality. Okay, let's see, anything else there? Did you notice a little potential jab? Not people a long time ago believed that their dreams to be just as real. The savage. So the people that you know today, right, for whatever reason, their mind is basically in that most primitive savage frame. If they can't simplistically differentiate, between the imagination in a dream and the reality of a relationship to external reality while you're awake. So, they always do that. They always give you that little reminder of just how basal you are if you're in that mode. And so don't expect, someone who is having a difficulty with that distinction to be able to hold on to much higher subtle discriminations. They're tenuously human. There's barely an observer, there that can stand apart from the thing observed and have some objective relationship to it. All right. Oh, yeah.
All the things that the adjuster is going off doing, once you fuse, it's stuck. It can't go do any of that stuff anymore.
It can't do any of that stuff anymore. Yeah, you're the great boat anchor. Right. I mean, before it fuses with you, it effectively goes from point A to point B at infinite speed. And is transcendent of almost everything. And then you glue yourself to it, and now it's transcendent of almost nothing. I mean, angels are above it. Right? This giant boat anchor just rips it down into the little thimble in time and space. And, if you thought it was imprisoned before fusion, it's like, wait till you fuse, adjuster. Then you'll really know how localized I am. But it will sacrifice, right, itself for your sake, right? It will set aside the possibility at some future time of it getting personalized in and of itself, and wait for your slowly upwelling personalization to give it the liberty that it is desired from the ends of eternity.
There is that anticipation. Like, you're a bone anchor, but now I've got access to personality.
Right. Yeah, personality. Yeah, once it fuses, personality isn't just a possibility anymore. Yeah. Like, boy, I hope one day I can have a personality. little Pinocchio, there.
What do you think their thought would have been about if you wake up before your soul snaps back into place? Is that blackened
up? You just reminded me that, I was going to make another little quick comment there. Yeah, you can just imagine how terrifying, and how seriously they would take all these ritualistic details, and what they might imagine in their terror, if someone wasn't awoken slowly. And, I'm sure that if someone is woken in a startled state and for a while is kind of discombobulated and, maybe even not their normal temperament. You know, everyone go, well, of course. I mean, your soul is missing. You know, they would explain it that way, and you know,
have some coffee.
Yeah. but the other thing there was that whole bit about you know, that the soul could be called back by speaking or shouting the sleeper's name. Yeah, besides the obvious, whoa, that one's going to get great confirmation. You know, you say their name, and again, sure enough, they wake up. Yeah, proof that you say their name, and the soul comes back. But then it adds to something they'll talk about here later on in the section about name. That sort of an event is what one of the reasons why just the fact of a name became deeply mysterious, you know, and gets put right there with the breath, you know, as the embodiment of the divine secret, you know, sort of, you know, the great mystery that's in play. Yeah, and again, obviously, a name is not something that you can kick like a football. You know, it's this very intangible thing, and they, you know, everyone knows they're looking for something that's as intangible as possible for this not body fact.
All down through the ages, men have stood in awe of the apparitions of the night season, and the Hebrews were no exception. They truly believed that God spoke to them in dreams, despite the injunctions of Moses against this idea. And Moses was right, for ordinary dreams are not the methods employed by the personalities of the spiritual world when they seek to communicate with material beings.
You know, if it ever happened, they would engage your mind, of course. Okay, but that, you know, not an ordinary dream, right? You might think it's a, you know, and the revelators at times might even cater to this and, you know, say that a being came to Joseph in a dream. Okay, not an ordinary dream. It's, you know, it's a dream-like mental experience, right? In that you're not, you know, seeing something in front of you with your eyes and shaking hands with it, you know, it's not that kind of an engagement. Okay.
Did you say ordinary?
Yeah, right. You know, an ordinary, you know, non-normal waking experience, you know, in your mind. You know, but is, you know, what will happen? But ordinary dreams, no, and you know, and even when Moses, because you've got the teachings of Machiavelli and Melchizedek coming down through the Kenites, getting into Moses and him having a little bit more objectivity about things. Okay, even when Moses tells them, no, God doesn't speak to you in dreams, do they believe it? No. I mean, there's no way to believe what Moses is saying, because by definition, God is the ghost. And ghosts are in dreams, right? He has to engage you in a dream. Where else would he engage you? That's the only time you engage the ghost world, right? See, so, I mean, you're not going to convince them otherwise, because they're not going to challenge their initial assumption that spirit beings are ghost land beings, and dream land is ghost land.
They know by experience, that's true.
Right. I mean, you know, especially someone who is certain that they had a dream where God talked to them. You know, not, it wasn't just Bob, right? But God talked to them in a dream. I mean, could Jesus convince Peter that Jesus wasn't literally in the external world pulling him up out of the water when he, you know, when he tried to walk on water and stuff? Could, no. You mean Jesus can tell him point blank. Peter's not going to believe what Jesus is saying. He can't believe what Jesus is saying. He would have to change his whole frame of mind for there to be any place for Jesus' statement to go in his head. Right? No, I absolutely engaged you because, see, Peter is in a savage frame of mind there. The savage believes his dreams right, to be just as real as any part of his waking experience. Okay? Just because you spend years with the Master himself doesn't suddenly magically evolve you or something. You can still just be that rudimentary, savage human mind that can't distinguish, because you have chosen basically to not let yourself be grown to the point where you can distinguish. See, that's the kicker here. You're using your free will to prevent the growth that would lead to a self-evident distinction. Right? You are holding on to that initial assumption with your will. And the Universal Father is impotent to do anything about your grip. It can't be changed until you let go. Right? So you won't grow one iota as long as you hold on to some of these savage level initial assumptions. You can't be grown. Right? That's why it's so important to let go of these things. It's not just some intellectual exercise.
That's something you just said about will. I think of will as something that I'm consciously aware of.
No. No, the problematic will is not the will that you're consciously aware of. The problematic will is the superconscious will, the unconscious will. That's the very problematic stuff. You've heard me say, I mean, one of the most startling, scary things that they say in the entire book is when they, just in passing, parenthetically one time, say that there's unconscious choices. Think about how ominous a statement that is, right? Not just unconscious decisions, sure. Unconscious choices. Bindings relative to eternity. Positively or negatively. Unconscious. Wow. I need to be very cautious here about running with what appears to be the case. What if one of those unfortunate unconscious choices filters down and becomes a predicate? It's like, I didn't make that choice. That obviously was put there by God. So that's a divine thought. So I'll just run with it. That could be very unfortunate. Right. You need to be cautious about what you find drifting into your conscious space. You can't be too humble. You can't be. Try humility. It's a good suggestion. All right, let's see what else we have here.
The ancients believed that souls could enter animals or even inanimate objects. This culminated in the werewolf ideas of animal identification. A person could be a law-abiding citizen by day, but when he fell asleep, his soul could enter a wolf or some other animal to prowl about on nocturnal depredations.
Nocturnal depredations. you're going to lay waste to something there. And again, it's like, this is all so ridiculous. How could anyone believe such superstitious foolishness? Again, you have no choice but to believe that until you change that initial assumption. Because there are animals and inanimate objects in the dreamscape, right? That's the ghost frame, right? So, yeah, if you know all that stuff is inspirited to begin with, then why couldn't it just, my spirit, my soul go over there, right? Yeah. So, remember, werewolf means literally man. Wolf. Where is man? And notice it's in that order. It's not wolf where, it's werewolf. Right? The wolf is what you have to begin with, and then the man is superimposed on top of that. Um, See, so I mean, it's all very rational, even in the coining of the word. And it sort of just has to be possible until you change that initial assumption. When they say, but when he fell asleep, you know, the foreboding way they're saying that. You know, again, remember what the word ghost means literally. It's, you know, the thing that you're frightened of. You know, the more this you kind of play upon this and the consequences of these initial assumptions about the ghost cult, the more fearful the whole scheme becomes. It's like, you know, like I was just trying to instill a little bit of humility about, you know, unconscious choices and, you know, how you might predicate yourself on those, thinking that God put it there, say. I mean, you know, humans have always been beset by, it's like, oh my goodness, what if, you know, and what if, and what if, and what if, and what if. Your illusions have no bounds. So, you know, you just, you know, your entire life is completely dominated by fear.
Probably lots of sleep disorders.
Right. You could just all, yeah. And so, yeah, don't be surprised if when you, you know, hear stories from back when, you know, there's all sorts of weird stuff, right? I mean, people are just completely twisted around inside by all, because they believe all these illusions are real. So, yeah, you know, it's going to lead to all kinds of mental disorders, obviously, and stuff. Yeah. All right.
Primitive men thought that the soul was associated with the breath, and that its qualities could be imparted or transferred by the breath. The brave chief would breathe upon the newborn child, thereby imparting courage. Among early Christians, the ceremony of bestowing the Holy Spirit was accompanied by breathing on the candidates. Said the psalmist, quote, "By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth." Quote, "It was long the custom of the eldest son to try to catch the last breath of his dying father."
Okay, right, so they're going to get back to this whole issue of exactly what is this not body fact. So you, like we said, the first really biggie that they were rationalizing with is the breath. And, you know, that carries all the way forward to present times, as they're saying. You don't have the distinction between the Spirit of Truth and the Holy Spirit, you know, so a Christian is thinking that bestowing of the Spirit of Truth is the bestowing of the Holy Spirit, and, you know, and it's all got to be a breath thing, because that's the not-body thing. And, you know, the psalmist in the 33rd Psalm there, you know, again, see, you've got the word of the Lord, you know, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made, you know, so in other words, you know, because he's a creator, right, he just says it, and, okay, the things are created, but, you know, to get the beings to be beings and not just other kinds of things, you can't just have the word that sort of creates the body of the being. You've got to have the breath. Right. You know, the host of them, you know, the host are the beings. Even if maybe in some primitive time, you know, or sense, someone was literally thinking of, say, the stars. You know, it's not proper to think that they're literally talking by the host, you know, that they're talking, you know, that's the starry host. Okay, no, that's the celestial beings. Let's see, anything else there? Notice that it's, you don't just have some simple, you know, kind of like monolithic or whatever you want to say concept of this not body fact. you have the breath, and that its qualities could be imparted or transferred, right? So, you know, it's some sort of a stuff, but it has all kinds of qualities, you know, and obviously it has to, because, you know, when you dreamed about yourself doing something, you know, you weren't, you had all of your temperament and whatnot. So, you know, this not body, this breath has to have qualities to it. Yeah. So you were, you know, there's, you know, you're obviously not looking very factually at breath in a cold climate and thinking, yeah, just what I see is what it is. Right? It's a amorphous mist. No, you're adding heavy illusion on that. You know, you're really not seeing it factually at all. Right? You're just seeing the illusion. So it has all of these qualities. Right? And the degree to which you haven't been scientifically trained, it will appear to you that you see those qualities. It's like, no, I didn't just imagine those. I saw them. Right? You know, and that goes, you know, into extreme lengths. You know, I mean, you can take that all the way to full-on hallucinations and whatnot. Okay, that, you know, someone who very firmly believes something, right, they don't just, you know, they aren't closing their eyes, you know, and they know they're closing their eyes and imagining. I mean, they have their eyes open, and they see rose petals falling from the heavens or whatever, right? They don't just like to imagine that there's invisible rose petals, you know, I mean, no, they see them, right? It appears to, you know, that they see them. You know, so you, obviously, the more you predicate reality on illusions rather than objective facts, the more this gets turned around. And seeing more and more of your apparently objective conscious experiences aren't, they're projections. Right, they're generated inside and pushed out there, you know, in your imagination. You know, as opposed to it's out there and I'm overlaying something on it. You know, it starts to kind of completely flip around. And you know, when you have someone that has some form of psychosis, you see, you know, this is what's happening, you know, to a greater degree. But you don't have to be in some way sort of, you know, clinically psychotic to be, just because of your beliefs and your, you know, your desire to be generating this whole illusory world that you think you're living in.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, for us, we have a more definitive sense of our individuation, so it's hard for us to really get into the mind of the savage.
Yeah.
If you think of the savage who doesn't have a very strong sense of himself as an individual, the whole group gets into this thing of fear just completely.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, great point. Because you're not, you know, because you're kind of just that minimal human as a savage, you're correct. You don't think of yourself in as individuated a way as we kind of just naturally do. You're more blurred. You see, into that animistic haze, you know. And so, yeah, see, it's just naturally more automatic that you can't separate, you know, what's in your mind from what's out in the external world. You know, you just aren't individuated as much. It all just is kind of blurring together. All right, let's keep going.
The shadow came later on to be feared and revered equally with the breath. The reflection of oneself in the water was also sometimes looked upon as proof of the double self, and mirrors were regarded with superstitious awe. Even now, many civilized persons turn the mirror to the wall in the event of death. Some backward tribes still believe that the making of pictures, drawings, models, or images removes all or a part of the soul from the body. Hence, such are forbidden.
Right, so it starts with the shadow, and then, see, like they're pointing out other kind of shadow-like things, you know, like reflections, or even then the concept of an image or whatnot. You know, we all know, like, you know, some savage, you take their picture and, you know, the Polaroid stole their soul, you know. But, you know, but again, the key one, like they're stressing there, is not so much reflections and things like that, but breath and shadow. Shadow is a very, very definitive one as well in many schemes of what this not body fact is. Remember, they touched upon that just, you know, briefly before about, you know, someone having a shorter shadow, you know, and stuff because their soul is lesser. Yep.
This is still depicted in movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where the reflection of the person, this person standing there, the reflection doesn't show in the mirror.
Right, right.
Well, why would they use that device if it didn't?
Yeah.
We didn't have that in our mind.
Right, so, you know, I mean, the vampire doesn't have a reflection because it doesn't have a soul. Right? That's not really a reflection of the body that you're seeing in the mirror. That's their soul. Right, that's the belief. So, if you know, to be consistent, you're going to tell a story about a being that doesn't have a soul, right? It can't have a reflection. Right, we still play those out. And the thing to remember is it's not just stories. You unconsciously, there's a part of your mind that is very comfortable with thinking about it that way. And to think otherwise, you have to actually overrule that basal, natural mode of thought. All this stuff we're reading is the way you would think if you were just thinking totally naturally. You know, it's not natural that you have a mind that grew up in the wake of the Enlightenment. I mean, human effort and reflective thinking and whatnot led to the Enlightenment and the environment that you just find yourself being born into that gives you a little bit more of a grounding in fact, in contrast to illusion and all that sort of stuff, you know, fosters you to be more individuated than you would be naturally. You know, don't take any of that stuff for granted. That's all, you know. We could easily, you take the environment away and all of what you benefit from goes away as well, right? And we would all slip back down. Or even, you know, if it's not the reflections, in spooky stories, you know, it's, the shadow knows, right? I mean, the very fact that you have that, you know, that character, is playing off of this fact that people, very definitively and still in some senses still believe, you know, that the shadow is the soul. You know, the ghost. Okay?
The soul was generally thought of as being identified with the breath, but it was also located by various peoples in the head, hair, heart, liver, blood, and fat. The quote, crying out of Abel's blood from the ground, end quote, is expressive of the one-time belief in the presence of the ghost in the blood. The Semites taught that the soul resided in the bodily fat, and among many, the eating of animal fat was taboo. Headhunting was a method of capturing an enemy's soul, as was scalping. In recent times, the eyes have been regarded as the windows of the soul.
Okay, so as humans mature and are able to identify more definitively with with abstractions, let's just say it that way, you know, they don't have to have something as, you know, direct as breath. It's like, I can feel that, or if it's cold, I can see that, Okay, so I can believe in that. You know, once you're able of having a more of identifying with more abstract notions, then you know it's almost unlimited where you could go with this. It's like, well, maybe it's the soul is in the head or in the hair or in the heart or in the liver or in the blood or in the fat. And remember, we saw them mention briefly about the anemic soul, right? That's where it's in the blood. You know, and the crying out of Abel's blood from the ground again. Right, so, I mean, blood is, you know, that one in more, you know, less savage, let's say it that way, less savage peoples, you know, got the idea of, fixated on the idea of being the blood somehow being fancy, you know, quite extensively. That was a winner in many, many people's minds. You know, even in quite semi-civilized peoples, it's, I'm sure it's in the blood. Everyone was sure it was in the blood. You know, and of course that's, you know, so not only do you have, vampires that don't have reflections because they don't have a soul, you know, they're drinking blood trying to get a soul. Right? To no avail. You know, they drink and drink and drink and they never do. Right? Because, you know, yeah, they're cursed. You know, a soul won't abide with them. Right, all those notions. Let's see. Anything else there? So you've got issues about swine just because they're swine. And then, of course, you know, all the fat of a swine, that just adds to it. See, as they're pointing out there, the Semites taught that the soul resided in the bodily fat. Right, so bacon, you know, okay, doesn't matter if it's the red part or the white part, it's like all deeply woo-woo. And forbidden.
But bacon is why a lot of people can't become vegetarians.
Yes, because it is just so inspirited. That's why you know it's evil.
You're bringing home the bacon.
Yeah, right. It's I don't mean to go off on that. Anyway, it's too irresistible. You know, to no bacon between the lines there. You know, and then of course you have a little bit more of a savage person, you know, and they're gonna need it to be a little bit more literal. So, you know, so it's head hunting, you know, or it's scalping. You know, but then again you go to the Semites and I think there was this guy named Samson, and there was something about his hair, right? And if you cut his hair, he lost his soul. And yeah, see, that's all that belief that the soul is in the hair. All right, so it's you've got, you know, it doesn't matter how much Moses tried to inject thoughts into the Hebrews, they're awash in all these different notions coming, you know, that they've picked up from every which direction, and you know, and they have this whole elaborate rationalization scheme that they've kludged together. Okay, let's see, I think we can, oh wait, well, there's that last little bit, so let's say you really decide to set aside all those sorts of kind of very literal notions of soul and the blood and stuff, but you're still wanting to have something kind of like that. So in recent times, the eyes have been regarded as the windows of the soul, right? Just, you know, I mean, how fancy eyes are and how much they seem to play when you look deeply into them. You can't help but, you know, bring all kinds of illusions into that. It's like those can't just be, you know, openings that photons go through and slam into, you know, the back of, you know, I mean, that's got to be, there's got to be a mystical conduit there or something. Right? Yeah. And so, right, you know, even if you don't literally think that the soul is in the eyeballs, their fanciness is like, well, I'm obviously looking through to the soul. Okay.
You can tell if they're being honest or not.
Right, and see, think about what, you know, then you start to conclude that, you know, kind of what you're picking up on there is the real person, you know, behind any sort of false fronts they're trying to put up or something. It's like, well, okay, maybe it's giving you the hints of what's in the lower domain, but you're not seeing what's in the upper domain. You know, you might be able to kind of pick up on, you know, and what's actually in their lower domain. But you're definitely not picking up what's in the upper domain, and you certainly are not picking up what's literally in that Marantxa mind, seated on that Marantxa object that's not in the hourglass at all. You know, the lower domain of which has eyeballs. Okay? All right? You know, the literalness of the Marantxa soul and the Marantxa self seated on that soul is very, very far removed from any notion of the eyes are regarded as the windows to the soul. But if you haven't gotten out of that old wineskin and you're reading your Marantxa book, right, you're going to carry that over. And every time they're talking about that Marantxa self and stuff, oh, yeah, yeah, and you can see that Marantxa self through someone's eyes. See, and you've just taken a false thought and made it a thousandfold more false, right, to do that. Okay.
Those who held the doctrine of three or four souls believed that the loss of one soul meant discomfort, two, illness, three, death. One soul lived in the breath, one in the head, one in the hair, one in the heart. The sick were advised to stroll about in the open air with the hope of recapturing their strayed souls. The greatest of the medicine men were supposed to exchange the sick soul of a diseased person for a new one, the, quote, new birth.
And you confirm this theory, because sure enough, the sick person, you know, spent some time in the fresh air and they got better, proving that they picked up their stray soul. Right? Right? Confirmations don't mean anything. You can confirm false theories. But you notice what's happening here. See, this is a more sophisticated individuals. You got a budding scientific mind going on here. All right? It can't be just something kind of really magical and amorphous and fuzzy. All right? I mean, it's like, no, it's starting to have a quote-unquote science to it. It's a false science, but it's a science. Right? Where, you know, it's like, well, okay, to make sense out of this, I can't just have one soul. I'm gonna need three or four, and I'm going to, you know, have to come up with a scheme for how they're related to the body and whatnot. So that's a mind that has a budding scientific consciousness that's now getting involved in this whole game of elaborating the ghost cult. Just see how rational, see, it is. The loss of one soul meant discomfort, two, illness, three, death. See, that's a rational thought. It's not a reasonable thought, but it's a rational thought. Right? It's a rudimentary scientific effort. You know, just, you know, you can imagine, you know, they don't go into it, but obviously you could imagine these, you know, have one in the breath, one in the head, one in the hair, one in the heart. It's like, well, okay, so when all is said and done, obviously that breath one is the one that goes into spirit land. And the other ones are to explain the complexities of this life here or something. You can just imagine how complicated this whole system could get and how much you could explain and understand, quote unquote, right, with this level of complexity. You add enough elements and it becomes easier and easier to rationalize anything. And it just seems to make complete sense. It's like, okay, there's no denying this theory. I mean, it is just, it works. It gets the correct answer every time. Okay? So again, just reminding you of that, how easy it is to construct a false science. Let's see here. And then the whole thing, why do they throw in that final thing of, the medicine man, is going to do this soul swap thing for you to heal you? And the quote-unquote new birth. Oh, so unless I'm very, very discriminating, as soon as I hear someone say born again, I'm going to be in that mode. Right. I'm going to be thinking about it in some way that's effectively like this when I hear born again. That will be my natural response to that term. I'm going to have to challenge myself to have a more sophisticated thought when someone says born again. And so that's why they're giving you that. Like I said, they're about to be very complete in this. It's what I've been saying. I mean, we all have to recognize that not only is kind of all this way of thinking about things natural, but it's the way all of religion forever has thought about everything. And so to do what the Urantia book is asking you to do is to go out beyond the whole scheme that's ever been in play. It's a huge challenge that they're giving you. All right.
The children of Badanan developed a belief in two souls, the breath and the shadow. The early Nadi races regarded man as consisting of two persons, soul and body. This philosophy of human existence was later reflected in the Greek viewpoint. The Greeks themselves believed in three souls. The vegetative resided in the stomach, the animal in the heart, the intellectual in the head. The Eskimos believe that man has three parts, body, soul, and name.
Okay, see, so this is the last one first. And see, so there where it's taking, put on equal footing. You're a three-part system, body, soul, and name. And, it's like, wow, that's pretty silly. Name, and right there with body. Like, well, okay, I mean, at least there's three things. You could tease that forward. Okay, yeah, body's body. Okay, what do you mean by soul? Okay, it's mind. Okay, and that very intangible thought you have, some essence thing with name, let's kind of coax that to spirit. There's sort of an order of transcendence there that has some truth to it. It's pregnant with some potential. It's going to take some work, right? But it's better than just, there's absolutely just two. Where you then willfully bound yourself away from ever allowing for spirit to be a third element. Yeah, it's got that anyway. The Greek thought's kind of interesting. You should have an immediate, okay, there's some truth there. Just the way the revelators say it. The vegetative resided in the stomach, the animal in the heart, the intellectual in the head. Okay, vegetative, animal, intellectual. Is there some measure of truth there? Well, yeah. There's the vegetable part of me, the mechanical mind. And the extent to which I'm calling soul mind. Okay, there's one mind. And then there's the mere agitant mind, the animal. Okay, that's a second quote-unquote soul mind. And then there's my spiritualized mind in the upper domain in the hourglass analogy. Right? That's a third. Yeah, see? Mechanical mind, agitant mind, spiritualized mind. See, there's a threefoldness there. There's a measure of truth there. with the Noddites, you know, you're thinking, now, what would the Noddites, some things that they, you know, that the original prince's staff knew and got would have handed off, and slowly the specifics got, you know, fuzzy. Okay, but you consist of, and notice it says two persons, even. So two souls there. It's like, well now, you know, is it the, you know, the mortal self and the moron and the adjuster self? Are those the two? Well, maybe, but I don't know. I mean, you know, here it's they're talking about souls, even if it maybe is kind of mind or whatever. But you know, let's go with the more immediate. Maybe, you know, it's those you, right? I mean, they would have kind of known that the adjuster is not them. So maybe that didn't feed forward. Maybe, you know, remember, there's three selves. There's your adjutant self, there's your mirage self, and those are both you. And then there's that third self, the adjuster self, and that's not you yet. So, you know, maybe what the Noddites are carrying forward is there's your adjutant self and there's your mirage self. Again, they don't explain because you can speculate. Maybe that's what's going on there. So all of these concepts, you notice how kind of more sophisticated and attempting to synthesize the Benonites, you know, were there. You know that, you know, they don't just go with breath like going forward from Anagar. You know, they bring in the shadow thing as well, and have a dual system. Just that, you know, is indicating, like I was just saying, a bit of human overlay of wanting to try to synthesize, you know, and not just say, well, we're the true people. We believe it's in the breath, and those false people over there, you know, believe it's in the shadow. No, they're open and accommodating. They synthesize it, right? They're like you know, the Catholic Church, right? Don't just reject everything. They just incorporate it all into a system. Okay, so everyone is welcome. All right, so that's kind of natural for humans to do that. Anyway, so I thought I'd just vamp on that a little bit because, see, they want you to do that. They don't want you to just, you know, the point is to think about the truth, you know, it's not just a scholarly fact that they're telling you. You know, see if you can understand where these people are coming from. All right, let's see. I think that's probably about all we need to say there. Let's continue on here and get a little bit some more details. You know, notice from the title here, we do need to begin to bring in more of this complexification of not just ghosts, but exalted ghosts that are spirits.
Section 6, the ghost-spirit environment. Man inherited a natural environment, acquired a social environment, and imagined a ghost environment. The state is man's reaction to his natural environment, the home to his social environment, the church to his illusory ghost environment.
Okay, so like I said, they're going to start being very definitive about this. The church, period. Humans have always had. What's that about? That's an institution predicated on the belief in the reality of the illusory ghost environment. And you mean it's only when you get very, very definitive about this being a separated fact that you really have the church. See, apart from, well, I mean, the home, for instance, right? Or the state, right? You know, to get the church, you know, you've got to get that quote unquote environment very definitively as a separate, independent fact. It's like, well, how can you do that? I mean, I thought you're thinking that you've got the natural environment that, you know, humans are in, and they die, and they become ghosts, and that's that other environment. Isn't that environment really kind of stemming from this? Yeah, initially, but eventually, like I was saying at the beginning, you abstract that away from the natural environment definitively. And you don't just think of it as being populated by ghosts, which are former mortals. Right? You think of it as inhabited by spirits that weren't, you know, former mortals. They just are in their own domain. See, once you get that fully separated, then you have the title. See, it's not the spirit-ghost environment, it's the ghost-spirit environment. See, where spirit is the foundational element, and ghosts are just sort of injected into that pre-existent, separate environment. Okay, that's what they're getting at there. And it's like, well, okay, now it's gone way off into superstitious la-la land. Well, okay, yes, but there's some positive things. This could allow you to separate church and state. Even though it's predicated on this whole illusory belief, in these transcendent ghosts that you're calling spirits that have their own environment. Okay, it doesn't matter. It's all imaginary. It will subtly motivate you to separate church from state because that environment is separated from your environment. So this is the way the evolutionary process works, right? We back into helpful improvements in the way we regulate ourselves, think about ourselves. And again, notice there's three environments. Matter, mind, spirit. Or at least the beginnings of our recognition of that definitive threefold. Right, a social environment, that's a mental environment. Mind. So, right, all of these are pregnant with potential. That's one of the reasons why they're saying them. They're encouraging you to, okay, now take the step like no one's done before you. Take it definitively. You know, and not some imaginary spirit environment. Know that there is, apart from any imagination, an objective spirit stuff environment. It's a separate stuff, has its own environment. Just like mind is a separate, quote-unquote, stuff, right? That has its own environment. But you can see it's going to be difficult because, it's less and less direct. Man inherited, okay, that's pretty direct, a natural environment. Acquired, okay, there's going to be some asterisks there. There's going to be some issues. Acquired a social environment and imagined a ghost environment. See, so, right, to get to the genuine spirit environment being just as literal as the material means you're going to have to, right, leave that imagination gateway to that environment behind. But nonetheless, it's threefold. That's something.
Very early in the history of mankind, the realities of the imaginary world of ghosts and spirits became universally believed. And this newly imagined spirit world became a power in primitive society. The mental and moral life of all mankind was modified for all time by the appearance of this new factor in human thinking and acting.
Okay, the mental and moral life of all mankind. Again, the universality of their statements here was modified for all time by the appearance of this new factor in human thinking and acting. It doesn't matter that it's all imaginary. Mind still dominates matter. Whether what's in the mind is a reflection of reality or is purely figment. Doesn't matter. The mind still dominates the body. So it's And then, you know, like I, then I, as I was saying, aside from that, just the fact that see, all of our thinking about all this is predicated on this illusory ghost environment. And, you know, you have to just chuckle at that first sentence. Very early in the history of mankind, the realities of the imaginary world. Wait a minute, the realities of the imaginary world? You know, again, it's when you're talking about mind over body, what's purely in the mind can have just as much impact on the body, you know, as it would if what's in the mind is a reflection of what is genuinely in reality. You know, like when you get to talking about people engaging Jesus and being cured, and Jesus didn't do anything. He didn't hand them a pill, you know, he didn't, you know, do his cool stuff, you know, with his power personality synthesis or anything. Right, they just believed, and their mind was made right. And especially, see, if what's all that's really twisted is just the mind, and it's not being sort of, the twisting in the mind is not being regenerated by some defects in the body. It's more wholly just in the mind. I mean, all the person has to do is just put themselves in a right mind, and ta-da, they're in a right mind. And the degree to which a twisted mind has physical manifestations, you know, associated with it, those physical things will clear up too. Right? You'll stop having those problems with your intestines or whatever. Right? And you don't have to do anything literally physical to them at all, because no material fact will ever be more powerful on the body than the mind is. You know, hitting the body with matter is hitting it, you know, horizontally. Hitting it with mind is hitting it from the top down. It's innately a dominant influence. The littlest bit of mind transcends all matter in terms of its influence on the body. Right? I mean, that should be trivially obvious. Just the tiniest little change in the state of my mind makes my hand fly around rapidly in front of my face right now. I mean, what kind of a drug would I have to take to get my hand to fly around wildly in front of my face like that? Some serious, potent, right, drug.
Voltage works.
Yeah, or a voltage. Yeah, a voltage might work too. But you get my point. I mean, a little bit of mind goes a long ways. I mean, you know, what kind of a drug would you have to give to a corpse to keep the corpse from decaying? That'd be a pretty potent drug. Mind just does it without even thinking about it. I'm
thinking about it.
All right? You don't have to consciously hold your body together. It just happens.
Don't drive while you're doing it.
That's also life animation.
No, it's mind is the coordinating influence. I mean, life animation added to the matter allows mind to interface with it so that it has an influence on it. But just because it's animate doesn't mean that it stays together.
But you age because that linkage between the animation and your matter is...
Right. Part of the coupling mechanism, if you will, is the life animation. So if that life animation related to the matter begins to, you know, not be as tightly identified, the mind can't be as identified. The coordinating influence can't be as tightly identified. But, you know, if you're near death and your body is losing its temperature regulation, that's not because the life animation is slipping away. And that's an a point to the aside. I mean, your body is losing its temperature regulation because mechanical mind is not engaged to the body as it should be. Right? And you know all the agitated mind is gone now. The only thing that's left connected to that body, if it's losing temperature regulation, is mechanical mind, and it's slipping. Okay, so death is close at hand. Mechanical mind is what makes this animated matter do all the coordinated things that it does. Take mechanical mind away, the mitochondria are not going to do what they do. Do you think molecules just do mitochondria stuff? who's the puppeteer of all those molecules, right? Oh, they aren't puppeting themselves.
Well, yep. I hear you right. The DNA, which we know, is just a sequence, pattern sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the mind then that correlates that pattern sequence with the body.
Right. Right. What's associating all this stuff? The matter doesn't self-associate. Let's get those molecules to arrange themselves after that little strip of DNA code. They don't just do that. Someone has, right? There has to be a carpenter.
Doctors.
Someone, right? Hammers and nails and boards, with the blueprint draped over them, don't assemble themselves into a house. There has to be a carpenter. Right? Nothing happens without mind. At least mechanical mind. And remember, to make a prokaryote, like a mitochondrion, do what it does. It's all it needs is mechanical mind. That's the plant part of you, very, very directly.
It'll be messy.
The vegetable part.
Yeah, the vegetable part of you. Yeah.
Vegetable soul.
Yes, the vegetative soul. Yeah. Which resides in a lot more than the stomach. It's there in every cell. Yeah. All right. Anyway. So back to section six here. Like I said. I mean, we're going to read a little bit more here. They're going to stress this just how what a challenge is in front of us to really get what the revelators are talking about, to get out of the old wineskin.
Into this major premise of illusion and ignorance, mortal fear has packed all of the subsequent superstition and religion of primitive peoples. This was man's only religion up to the times of Revelation, and today many of the world's races have only this crude religion of evolution.
Okay, see, there it is, the point blank era. Okay. Except for, the handful of exceptions, right, where Revelation has had a lasting impact, as they're saying there, all of the subsequent religion of primitive peoples, right, not just superstition, right, but all of the religion, period, no exception. And it all is self-generated like this and can have, nearly incomprehensible complexity. Doesn't matter. All is self-generated. And as they point out, most religions still on the planet, even the best of it, is just very minimally has a revelatory predicate, and so you could say it's semi-civilized. All the rest of it is barbarous. Right? It's bottom-up, self-generated. Right? You start out as a savage, and you well up naturally to a barbarian, But that's it. You can't go any further without revelation. It takes revelation to spark a more transcendent usage of your personal gifts that were given to you by grace. They don't just bubble up any higher on their own. They need to be catalyzed. Like this book can catalyze, you know, thoughts in your mind that you never could have had. Just a few statements, and all of a sudden your mind is functioning at a higher level that is just, it was completely out of, you know, range for you before. You know, and that's the purpose of revelation. You know, everything from the literalness of what the biologic uplift that comes with the Edenic teachings, you know, the actual direct revelation. But, you know, but again, you know, it's synchronized with it. You know, humans naturally biologically evolve and then plateau, and they can't go any higher until they're literally uplifted biologically by Adam and Eve. And you know, the really important part is the mind that gets uplifted by revelation. Before that, you know, with that biologic uplift, and, you know, after that biologic uplift. Right, the whole point is to lift yourself, not your body. Right, your body doesn't ascend. It's yourself that ascends. That's what needs to be uplifted. I'm not overplaying it, as you can see from that paragraph. They're trying to get us to face this fact that when the book is talking about God, you don't know what it's talking about. You can't know what it's talking about. Because we're all steeped in God, that word symbol being merely this, the most exalted ghost notion. All right? He's inescapably anthropomorphic. Okay? So what they're, you know, trying to, another way of saying what they're trying to tell you there. So you just have to try to somehow set all of that aside, everything you ever thought you knew about God, and be born again, really born again, to a whole new frame that has no relationship to that ghost cult frame. It's not predicated on you at all. Like I was saying, you know, don't just make the journey totally apart from the natural environment in your imagination. Make it really get to the religion of the spirit, right? Not the religion of the ever more fancily exalted, you know, material predicated mind. But found yourself completely from that. Take that leap of faith, right, that lets go of all matter and grabs a hold of the other stuff and starts totally new, 180 degrees turned around. That's the challenge. All right, let's keep going.
No. Just above.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty potent. Modified for all time by the appearance of
mm-hmm.
the new factor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Just in case you were wondering if it's challenging.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention, into this major premise of illusion and ignorance. Oh, well, that's a great starting point. Oh, and then mortal fear has packed. Wow, what a construct. A framework of illusion and ignorance packed plumb full to the gills with fear.
But you need it. You have to have the scaffolding or you can't take that.
Yeah, right. Again, see, again, none of this is evil. It's an inescapable, you know, starting point. But just don't think of it as an ending point. That's the only problem. It's a wonderful starting point. Like I was trying to say, three things. It's like, well, at least it's three things. See, it's a starting point. But don't think of it as an ending point. Right? It's good in truth. Not in fact, okay? But it's good in truth. Start there and you know, play upon that potential.
Yeah. The facts to face.
Okay.
As evolution progressed, good luck became associated with good spirits and bad luck with bad spirits. The discomfort of enforced adaptation to a changing environment was regarded as ill luck, the displeasure of the spirit ghosts. Primitive man slowly evolved religion out of his innate worship urge and his misconception of chance. Civilized man provides schemes of insurance to overcome these chance occurrences. Modern science puts an actuary with mathematical reckoning in the place of fictitious spirits and whimsical gods.
Here's where, you know, they're going to poke you a little bit about insurance policies. It's like, okay, it's an improvement, but again, notice it, they're trying to remind you that actually it's just the old thought reworked. It isn't genuinely a new thought, totally bounded away from the superstitious beginnings. Right? Instead of assuming that there's fictitious spirits and whimsical gods, it's their doings that you have to have an insurance policy against, you know, with all the woo-woo of some primitive religious scheme, okay, that will bound you away from their whimsicalness or whatever. What are you doing? Are you really doing anything that different and genuinely improved? No, you're saying it's like, well, you know, there's just the doings, and an actuary, you know, literally the word, is the individual that calculates the doings. Right? You know, act is to do, literally. Right? Okay. Right, and then you have an insurance policy against, it's like, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. It's just the doings. What are you going to do about, you know, what whimsical gods do? I mean, that's just what they do. Nothing you can do about it. You're just going to have to work with that. Yeah. You know, nature just does stuff. There's nothing you can do about it. You're just going to have to work with it, with an insurance policy. It's primitive. Right. What you have to eventually recognize is, no, you're not powerless here. Right? You need science, genuine science. And you can take control of all this stuff. You won't have to have an insurance policy against hurricanes because there won't be any more hurricanes. You'll control the weather. Right? Instead of just saying, you know, I'm a helpless victim of antecedent causation, you know, of just the doings of nature or the doings of whimsical gods. You know, in the end, there's no difference between those two thoughts.
Well, it says act of God right in the policy.
Right, and it says act of God still in the policy, for Pete's sake, right? That's what they're trying to get at. Yeah, you know, we think we're really sophisticated because we have, you know, this actuary, you know, this shaman, right, uses statistics, you know, as if the universe, you know, is just a random phenomenon with no purposing behind it and no purposing that can engage it. No, you know, so that statistics, you know, is the only thing that you can do with it, right? No.
You're not suggesting that it's not prudent to have insurance.
Of course I'm not suggesting it's not prudent. Yeah, it's, no, but you just see what the point they're trying to make is, in the delight of being prudent, you know, having material pragmatism, you know, and dealing with, you know, having money to rebuild, you know, when the hurricane washes your house away. Wow, I was clever. Instead of being satisfied with your cleverness there and seeking nothing higher, right, see, don't be satisfied. Don't be held back by your assumption that there's nothing you can do about these things. Will you discover the science that can control this stuff if your initial assumption is there's nothing you can do about it? It's beyond human control? Of course you won't discover. Right? Do hurricanes wash homes away when the planet is settled in light and life? No. No. Do tornadoes tear through Oklahoma towns? No. Right? That's what they're trying to get at.
They don't build jet planes either.
Right? It's like I said, oh, I discovered transcendence. I went from the level of the flesh to the level of the feelings. I'm satisfied. I've gotten to the ceiling. And it's just like that. You take one step and you think you've taken the step and you're done. No. Right. It's a step. Fine. Okay. But don't stop there. Don't be satisfied. Especially because there's no way that that first step can be anything but an extrapolation of where you started. You're going to have to take quite a few steps before you're actually bounded away from just, you know, stretching the rubber band farther and further from where you started. You have to go beyond the elastic limit. And that's kind of scary. You're going to have to let go. Let's see. And then, of course, if that wasn't controversial enough, let's try the discomfort of enforced adaptation to a changing environment is regarded as ill luck. Does that have any relevancy to climate change and the way we think about it? Well, it's obviously bad because there's discomfort of enforced adaptation. So, I mean, if I'm discomforted, that's the definition of badness. So it's obviously anyone that would be causing a change in the climate is evil. See, we're thinking this in the same way we've always thought. Like, no, it's a great sign that the fact that we could actually, that we believe that we might actually be able to impact the environment, you know how recent that is? I mean, how much that's getting beyond the insurance policy thing? Where you think, well, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, the environment, like humans could have an effect on the environment. No, because we've noticed, we have. Instead of going, oh, cool, let's just keep going forward, and eventually we'll have enough genuine knowledge that we can really control it, and we don't have to be discomforted in these gross ways anymore. No, instead our ghost cult fears are awakened, and it's like, oh my God, back up, stop doing anything that might impact the environment. See, we're primitives.
Well, there were those that
wanted
to get giant fans.
It's just, and again, it doesn't mean that you don't alter your behavior. I mean, like they said, this whole bit about, was modified for all time by the appearance. I mean, there might be some positive things of how we modify our behavior based upon our illusions and fears, about a changing environment or stuff. Right? And we progress in spite of ourselves. Okay. But still, right?
It's the old predicate.
The Revelation is trying to challenge us to not, to start to take a hold of this courageously and not just be this framework filled with fear. A framework of illusion and ignorance filled with fear. And we've got to go beyond that. And they're trying to challenge us that. And it's not looking very hopeful the way things are going these days. We're just finding new fears to cram into the illusory, ignorant frame. Now we're afraid of this and that and the other thing. I mean,
gotta keep it well packed.
Right.
No unpacking.
Right. I mean, we have ever more boogeymen, and then we turn the world. See, again, it starts to become, there has to be no difference between the man you fear and the things in the environment that you fear. See, actually, it's starting to become very animistic again, and it's all blurring together, and it's just very primitive. All right. The other thing you see there at the beginning is something we'll get into a lot when we get into the next paper, the whole bit about dual spiritism. Right, that as evolution progressed, good luck became associated with good spirits and bad luck with bad spirits. Right, that dichotomy that you then impose upon this domain that you now believe is apart from the material domain. Let's see. Yeah, and then they also mention, see, remember, it starts with the sixth adjutant, right, the innate worship urge, and his misconception of chance. And they were just reminding you, remember, that's how this all started. And then we've got this whole ghost thing going. So that's the scheme we've got.
Each passing generation smiles at the foolish superstition of its ancestors while it goes on entertaining those fallacies of thought and worship which will give cause for further smiling on the part of enlightened posterity.
See, if you didn't get what I just said about the contrasting of the two insurance policies, this, they have a whole paragraph to try to get you to, right. It's just, you know, like they're saying there. While it goes on entertaining those fallacies, it's the same fallacies, just made fancier so you think they aren't the same fallacies. But it's fundamentally the same fallacy. While no one really has free will, no one can really take control of the situation, you're just a helpless victim. Very, very sad, unfortunate thing to think.
Doesn't this process continue on in the mansion worlds? They have the reversion directors. I'm sure
they're smiling. Right. I mean, it's important for those reversion directors to you know, remember, you can't understand anything until there's a contrast. And so the reversion directors are helping to improve understanding by helping you with contrasts. Like, you know, there's this, and then there's this. There's this, and there's this. You go back and forth. Oh, I get it. Right? And they, you know, so they have this sort of blink comparator, you know, they flash back and forth between, oh, I see the difference, right? It's astronomers, you know, like astronomers on a photograph looking for, you know, two photographs taken at different times looking for an asteroid, you know, and you blink back and forth between them, and wait a minute, there's this one little white dot that moves between the two photos, right? And you understand then, oh, that's not a star, a fixed star. You have to have some sort of a contrast. Right?
But at last, the mind of primitive man was occupied with thoughts which transcended all of his inherent biologic urges. At last, man was about to evolve an art of living based on something more than response to material stimuli. The beginnings of a primitive philosophic life policy were emerging. A supernatural standard of living was about to appear, for if the spirit ghost in anger visits ill luck, and in pleasure good fortune, then must human conduct be regulated accordingly. The concept of right and wrong had at last evolved, and all of this long before the times of any revelation on earth.
And despite all the revelation, no one has ever changed the definition of right and wrong. Still to this day, right and wrong is defined in terms of correct and incorrect conduct relative to the illusory spirit world, of course. But just fundamentally, you know, right is correct conduct. No, right is not correct conduct. Any more than truth is correct understanding. Those are the primitive definitions of those words. And I'll get to that in the next paper. And you have to bound yourself away from that. It's going to be difficult. Right? That's what the dictionary says. That's what everyone that's ever lived has thought. The greatest ethicist, you know, philosopher that's ever lived hasn't understood what right and wrong mean. Okay. It has nothing to do with correct, incorrect conduct relative to the mores, you know, let alone the taboos tied to the illusory spirit world. Okay. But, like they're saying, sure, okay, all kinds of issues there, but at least, I see, but at least, see, like the paragraph starts out, you are beginning to have your mind not purely predicated on material stimuli. Okay, you haven't made the full journey yet where it's genuine spiritual stimuli, but at least it's not merely material stimuli. It's what you're generating within the mind itself. You know, and one part of the mind is stimulating another part, you know, as it were. And you're regulating your conduct relative to that. And, but of course, again, there's just that. It's like, well, isn't there a positiveness to regulating conduct? Yeah. And it's, and so that's a positive step, even though it's all predicated on illusion. There's no reality to the why you're changing your conduct, but you change your conduct and it's an improvement. You don't kill everyone you meet now. That's handy. You know, these things are an improvement. The gods have told me that we shouldn't eat our captors anymore. So you stop eating your captors. Ah, okay, that's an improvement. your captives, you're eating your captives. The captors eating the captives. I mean, a lot of those steps forward, you know, was because, you know, someone got the notion that the spirits didn't like that, you know, and no one's going to be happy if you do something the spirits don't like. You know, everything goes to hell in a handbasket. There's going to be a tornado or, you know, a blizzard or whatever. So, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. And that's how all that stuff has happened up until now. And they're wondering what it would be like if we went made improvements predicated on reality instead of illusion, even if the illusions in the end were a helpful stimulus. What if, you suppose reality would be a better systemic stimulus?
Only if it's more vivid.
Right, and that's the trick.
That's problematic.
How do you get genuine spirit stimuli to be more vivid than what you can generate in your mind? Yeah, you know I've talked about that a lot. That's not an easy feat. Those vivid islands you can generate totally inside, you know, they almost know no wattage limit. Okay? Not easy, right, to get above those and get to what initially is a still small voice of spiritual stimulus. Not that booming high wattage vivid island of heat that you generate. Okay. You're not going to be, you know, you're going to go, seriously? You think I should pick that over this? This is so much more exciting than still small voices.
Your contrast.
Especially if the still small voice leads to the end effect that there will be discomfort. Mm-hmm. Why would I follow a voice like that? I like my self-generated voices to lead that lead to milk and honey. Right?
Warm.
Yeah, this is why it's been so difficult. Okay.
With the emergence of these concepts, there was initiated the long and wasteful struggle to appease the ever-displeased spirits, the slavish bondage to evolutionary religious fear, that long waste of human effort upon tombs, temples, sacrifices, and priesthoods. It was a terrible and frightful price to pay, but it was worth all it cost. For man therein achieved a natural consciousness of relative right and wrong. Human ethics was born.
Okay. So, again, another one, you know, where something happened, but, you know, you've got this issue, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Let's look at what they're, you know, how, again, how strong the statement is there. With the emergence of these concepts, there was initiated a long and wasteful struggle. Right, it's this whole bit about correct conduct, right? You know, relative to this imaginary space. To appease the ever-displeased spirits, the slavish bondage to evolutionary religious fear, that long waste of human effort upon tombs, temples, sacrifices, and priesthoods. That's slightly controversial, is it not? Right? That long waste of human effort upon temples, for instance. Oh, but that temple is so beautiful, and I know it brings me closer to God, and it's so magnificent when I'm in it, and look what they're saying there. It's like, no, it doesn't really do any of that stuff. It might bring you closer to the imaginary environment in your mind, because it alters your feelings, and that alters where you are in your mind. And but it doesn't do one whit to bring you in relationship to spiritual reality. Not one priest, not one temple. Yeah, you can probably go with not one sacrifice. It's not so controversial, you know, amongst us anymore. You know, not one tomb. None of it. That's a pretty aggressive statement. I guess. I mean, see, for someone who, that's the only thing they have to hold on to. I mean, to have, you know, no qualifying statements really, just have that ripped away, that's an aggressive move, right? Jesus wasn't preaching from the Urantia book, right, to the masses. That would have been very cruel. But this thing is just laying it out there. But see, then the double-edged sword. It was a terrible and frightful price to pay. Yeah. But it was worth all it cost. Because what happens? You actually start to regulate your conduct. Notice there that relative right and wrong, human ethics was born, not human morality. Okay, but at least you start to get into this notion of what it's not true ethics, but it's ethics, even though it's a false ethics, but it's ethical. You're considering others, not just yourself. But you haven't made the full journey. Right? I mean, if you finally journey far enough in and up, all those others disappear. And when you get all the way up, there's just you and the cosmos. No others. You know, and you have morality, your conformity with the cosmos, not your correct conduct relative to others or, you know, no. Something transcendent of that. Something that is just about your character, and then all of your subsequent engagement of others is predicated on that cosmic foundation. And then that subsequent ethics, that top-down ethics, predicated on genuine morality, I see that's true ethics then. You know, it like they're saying, at least you're getting started. But like I was saying, that whole contemplation of right and wrong is incorrect, you know, that humans have been doing, because it's all, you know, about ethics. Right and wrong are moral words, not fundamentally ethical words. There's genuine right and wrong is just all there is you and your conformity with the cosmos. See, it's a very abstract thing. You had some question.
Well, I'm just thinking how confused I've been even now.
Mm-hmm.
In my thinking about ethics, I've tried to overlap the teaching on how I understand how most people consider ethics.
Yep.
And it's like, huh? It can be ethics without morality? Because I've started thinking ethics as being like a derivative of morality, you know, top down. But evolutionally, the morals aren't there.
Right, right. Remember what I said. I've said many times. I mean, the word moral was just coined by Cicero to have a Latin word as a synonym for the Greek ethical. Right. It was a synonym for ethical. Right. It's evolved a slight difference, and the revelators are saying, "Yeah, you notice that slight difference that you sometimes try to put words to? Take it the rest of the way. See, fully separate them. Find that genuine moral core of your conformity to the cosmos on that other end of your mind." That's subject to spiritual stimuli and is completely apart from the material stimuli end of your mind and all those others that come in through that, you know, that material stimulus avenue. I mean, I don't know about you and, you know, your existence in the room because of a spiritual stimulus on my mind. You know, the fact that you're in the room is totally predicated on material stimuli and all of the baggage that brings into play. Let's see if we can get a little bit more here. This is the section that's got one of the most important paragraphs in the book.
Section 7, the function of primitive religion. The savage felt the need of insurance, and he therefore willingly paid his burdensome premiums of fear, superstition, dread, and priest gifts toward his policy of magic insurance against ill luck. Primitive religion was simply the payment of premiums on insurance against the perils of the forests. Civilized man pays material premiums against the accidents of industry and the exigencies of modern modes of living.
Oh, they're doing it again. Yeah, not to say that you should, you know, burn all your insurance policies, okay, but they're just reminding you. Yeah, primitive man did this, civilized man does this. Okay, in the big picture, there's no difference, right? It's just because it's the same initial assumptions, right? You know, you're this powerless victim. I mean, if you want to transcend victimology, right, in our society, you've got to stop thinking like this. What are we to do against, you know, the forces of nature?
So get the insurance policy and...
I mean, material pragmatism, for one, and find genuine spiritual idealism. Right? Bounded away from those material pragmatic issues. Not in contrast, you know, not in an antithetical contrast to those material pragmatism issues, but... seek first the kingdom of heaven. Right? Seek first something transcendent of all modes of insurance policies. Right? And then deal with insurance policies. Right? That's what Jesus said.
Right?
Yeah, well, they're about to, you know, they're about to read the next paragraph how this has evolved. Yeah.
Modern society is removing the business of insurance from the realm of priests and religion, placing it in the domain of economics. Religion is concerning itself increasingly with the insurance of life beyond the grave. Modern men, at least those who think, no longer pay wasteful premiums to control luck. Religion is slowly ascending to higher philosophic levels in contrast with its former function as a scheme of insurance against bad luck.
Right, so much of religion is just a scheme of insurance against bad luck. And like they're saying, it's slightly transcended that. It's like you're not trying to deal with the vicissitudes of time. You know, you're trying to get an insurance policy relative to eternity. What do I have to do to guarantee, right, that no matter what else happens in my life, no matter, you know, what I might, where I might slip up and do things, when all is said and done, I'm going to make it to heaven, right? All I have to do is sprinkle some magic water on me, and then I can kill as many people as I want, and I'll be okay. Okay, I'll do that, right? You know, it all becomes that, you know, salvation thing. And so, you know, here, you know, they're even trying to get you to question, you know, basic insurance against hurricanes and stuff like that, you know, your initial assumptions about it, feeling so helpless. But also, you know, what does it tell you point blank in the book? That other thing that you think religion is about? No, you should take your salvation for granted. There's nothing to do there. There's nothing, absolutely nothing of genuine religion that has anything to do with that. It's like, well, what the heck is religion about then? If it isn't about insurance policies. Yeah. There's the question. Yes. Yes. He's just your mystical insurance agent, you know, that you call him, and you call him a pastor. Yes. That's funny. It's just, okay, a little bit more here.
But these ancient ideas of religion prevented men from becoming fatalistic and hopelessly pessimistic. They believed they could at least do something to influence fate. The religion of ghost fear impressed upon men that they must regulate their conduct, that there was a supermaterial world which was in control of human destiny.
See, and that what the italicizer, see, like I've already said that. That's the key. Regulate their conduct. And not being totally fatalistic and, you know, pessimistic like they're saying. I mean, but we, as I've been stressing, we need to go a lot further, right? We still think, well, all I can do is just get an insurance policy about, you know, the forces of nature, right? And the actuary will tell me what the proper premium is. That's very... That's a very limited, fearful, you know, sense of self. But like they're saying, I mean, see, you have the beginnings of this. No, we can do something. We need, if we just get enough scientific knowledge, right, and put it into practice, we're not helpless victims of our environment anymore. And the seeds for that courage to lean into it like that. You know, it started with this whole imaginary scheme, right? You didn't think it's like, well, you know, there's nothing I can do. I'm just fated. It's like, no, it's like if you do this woo-woo thing, you know, then you won't, bad luck won't befall you. You thought you could do something. You weren't just hopelessly fatalistic. You know, and there were a lot of peoples, you know, that were just totally stuck in that, you know, and still are. You know, the stars dictate that I'm like this. I'm just fated that way. There's nothing I can really do to change my temperament. My temperament is dictated by the stars. Okay. Well, yeah, there isn't anything that you can do to change the temperament that's predicated on your genetics. It's not the stars, right, that is the origin of it, it is your genetics. But there is definitely something that you can do to change your character. Your character in the upper domain, that's subject to your free will control. It's not a helpless victim of genetics. Your temperament in the lower domain, okay, yeah, in this life perforce you serve two masters. And, you know, you can't totally change that.
You know, I'm sovereign somewhere.
Yeah. We really are sovereign somewhere. And you can not only do something, you can do everything there. Okay, now here's the big meaty paragraph.
Modern civilized races are just emerging from ghostphere as an explanation of luck and the commonplace inequalities of existence. Mankind is achieving emancipation from the bondage of the ghost spirit explanation of ill luck. But while men are giving up the erroneous doctrine of a spirit cause of the vicissitudes of life, they exhibit a surprising willingness to accept an almost equally fallacious teaching which bids them attribute all human inequalities to political misadaptation, social injustice, and industrial competition. But new legislation, increasing philanthropy, and more industrial reorganization, however good in and of themselves, will not remedy the facts of birth and the accidents of living. Only comprehension of facts and wise manipulation within the laws of nature will enable man to get what he wants and to avoid what he does not want. Scientific knowledge leading to scientific action is the only antidote for so-called accidental ills.
So let's do the deal with that, the final part first, right? Because I've been stressing that all the way going back to the first mention of insurance. See, that's the punchline that I've been stressing. Scientific knowledge leading to scientific action is the only antidote for so-called accidental ills. Not only, and there's two sources, you know, they say there, right? That only comprehension of facts and wise manipulation within the laws of nature will enable man to get what he wants and to avoid what he does not want. Right? All that stuff, you know, they're talking about, we'll talk about in a minute here, will not remedy the facts of birth and the accidents of living. Right? The facts of birth and the accidents of living. There's two elements. Right? There's your genetics. Some of this stuff is inescapable because of our genetics. The only way to not get what we don't want is to change our genetics through genetic engineering. And the other is the scientific knowledge, you know, about the external world. You know, the very removed external world. Like I said, you know, controlling weather and whatnot, or having unlimited, you know, energy resources, or you know, whatever. All of that is the solution. Is not insurance policy. More and more insurance policies. The solution is science, genuine science, which we have less and less and less of. Okay. So we're going to have to rely more and more on insurance policies, which will naturally flip back into shamans. The actuaries will go back into shamans. So there's that. Now that's the key. But the reason this is a really, really biggie paragraph is what's right before that stuff. Right? There is an ism that we've constructed that has these fundamental assumptions as its principles. You know, that all human inequalities, right, stem from political misadaptation, social injustice, and industrial competition. Right, which can be remedied by new legislation, increasing philanthropy, redistribution, and more industrial reorganization. That ism is progressivism. Okay. Right. Progress, yes, especially genuine progress, right? But not this ism, you know, which is, like they're saying, is about as false an ism as you could construct. But while men are giving up the erroneous doctrine of the spirit causes of the vicissitudes of life, they exhibit a surprising willingness to accept the almost equally fallacious teaching of progressivism. And I mean, you guys know that just sort of a simple little unelaborated statement that I posted years ago about that, that little political fallacy thing that I stuck in the library where I gave this paragraph, and then I just said this simple little statement and left it at that. Who has not heard a politician claim that some human inequality is caused by political misadaptation, which can be corrected by enacting new legislation? Who has not heard a politician claim that some human inequality is caused by social injustice, which can be corrected by imposing increasing philanthropy? Who has not heard a politician claim that some human inequality is caused by industrial competition, which can be corrected by forcing more industrial reorganization? Right. No one has not heard that. Right? That is the mode. You know, like they said, okay, however good in and of themselves, right? It doesn't matter how much legislation you pass, how much redistribution, you know, you demand, how much you reorganize industry, not one iota of human inequality will be changed. Because that's not where that's not the source of human inequality. It doesn't matter how much you might see them associated and assume that there's a causal linkage, there isn't. Human equality is caused by, what did they say? The facts of birth and the accidents of living, which can only be changed through scientific knowledge leading to scientific action.
That's convenient.
Yeah. You know, but boy, where would politicians be if they didn't have this great fallacy?
All the people who are running right now for 2020 are exactly
that's
like
the plan.
Right. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's the so-called left or the so-called right. It's all progressivism in one form or another. Yeah. One might prefer redistribution and one might prefer regulation, you know, or whatever. But okay, but it's all a fallacy. It's not going to change human inequality. You might want to do it for other reasons, just like you might want to have an insurance policy. Okay, but right, it's the fallacious overlay that you have, you know, upon these things. That's the problem. You know, that's the bigger problem, the bigger issue. Progressivism is an extremely corrosive ism, right there with secularism and humanism and positivism. It's one of the four really noxious isms. Okay? Like they're saying here, it's hyper fallacious. Those of you who've listened to me for a long time, you know I often refer to this, and this is the paragraph. You can go back and reflect and just, how there's reasons for these things relative to material pragmatism. Okay, but the fallaciousness is when, you know, instead of spiritual idealism, you have this material idealism, you know, that they think, you know, that you think that this is going to address.
Okay. But I say we wouldn't have gotten to this point if we weren't giving up ghost fear.
Yeah, right. See, so it's a step. But see, if in the sense that ghost fear is the child, this almost equally fallacious thing is the adolescent. And the most dangerous time is not when you're a child, it's when you're an adolescent. The revelation didn't come when we were children. It came when we were adolescents. Even Jesus' adolescence, everyone in the universe was holding their breath. Is he going to make it through this? This could all blow up really bad here. Right? I mean, that's we're in this difficult transition state.
People are giving up they're giving up religion, which to them is belief in ghosts.
Right.
But they haven't found true religion.
Right. These.
Well, but how do you find true religion if you give up evolution?
Right. It's a very tricky thing. To make this transition, yeah, you know how if you give up that very primitive evolutionary religion, you don't turn off the sixth adjutant. And so that's what I'm saying. You've got this, the sixth adjutant gets applied to ideas and turns them into isms. And some of those isms are, they really satisfy everything that evolutionary religion did. They're a complete lifestyle solution. And are very, very problematic because of that.
Very destructive.
Very destructive. Mm-hmm. That's why I stress those. That's why the Revelators did a whole section up in the Jesus Papers on secularism and humanism. This is a challenge. It gets back to when we were talking about civilization. I mean, when you're voting for people, and what politicians should be putting themselves forward as, you're dealing with government. It's a material pragmatism domain. And all of this idealism stuff, false idealism, because it's material idealism, that's totally inappropriate. You're not voting for a high priest. You're voting for an administrator of physical affairs. And if their heads are off in some visionary cloud, right, of false idealism, they're not going to manage the material affairs of impersonal government very well.
Yeah, so it leads to open borders.
It leads to all sorts of blurring between the material and the spiritual. Yeah. All right.
Industry, war, slavery, and civil government arose in response to the social evolution of man in his natural environment. Religion similarly arose as his response to the illusory environment of the imaginary ghost world. Religion was an evolutionary development of self-maintenance, and it has worked, notwithstanding that it was originally erroneous in concept and utterly illogical.
Again, another way of saying, we seem to progress in spite of ourselves, don't we? Yeah, again, but that only takes you so far. I mean, if something is utterly illogical, you probably can't get to the age of light and life. In that frame. You have to so transcend. Remember, technically, when you get way settled in light and life, you don't even talk about science, philosophy, and religion as the triplet anymore. Right? You fundamentally have full holistic philosophy, and there's the individuality phase of it, which is cosmology, and there's the unity phase of it, which is divinity. And you've really left science and religion, as we kind of think of them, behind, because it's more of a moda-like state of affairs, where that kind of philosophy, that kind of genuine, true philosophy, is the mortal equivalent of moda consciousness. We've unpacked all the basic elements of that paragraph already. But before they leave you, they want to remind you, religion similarly arose as his response to the illusory environment of the imaginary ghost world. That's what everyone calls religion. And that's not what you're looking for. There's no religion of the spirit there. That's the religion of the mind.
Primitive religion prepared the soil of the human mind by the powerful and awesome force of false fear for the bestowal of a bona fide spiritual force of supernatural origin, the thought adjuster. And the divine adjusters have ever since labored to transmute God fear into God love. Evolution may be slow, but it is unerringly effective. Presented by an evening star of Nebadon.
Again, just reminding how this stuff works as a beginning, but is also not an ending. You know, and that full contrast, God fear into God love. Zeroth level of meaning all the way to the sixth level of meaning. You've got to cross the whole expanse to get from God fear to God love. Like you're saying, I mean, to get to the genuine spiritual level where there's the influence of spiritual stimuli, and you're totally now separated from the material stimuli end of your mind, which is nothing but fear-based. So it's just another way of saying what I've said multiple times tonight. You know, that they're just trying to get you to stress that. And notice how they said that false fear. Remember, I mean, you know, true fear, if you will, is kind of limited. But false fear is kind of limitless. I mean, there's no limit to the imaginary things that you can have and then fear. You know, and that's why they say the things they do about that. It's just, I mean, it's a powerful force. I mean, you can amp up a fear in your mind predicated on this imaginary stuff, you know, that no literal thing out there can ever, you know, no snarling carnivore can ever get you to have a fear that profound in your mind, like you can generate within yourself. So.
You can even be afraid of the oceans pushing in the walls,
you know,
the walls of your house.
Yeah, and again, we don't want to, we talk about these things not to, boy, am I glad I'm not like that person over there who thinks that. Remember, this is what we're all stuck in, and the challenge is for you to just not have yet another flavor of this that you think is an improvement just because it's different from that guy's superstition. All right? I mean, to genuinely go up, you know, and not be in that Pharisaic mode of, boy, I'm glad I'm not like that guy over there, you know, who is worried about, you know, whatever. So next time, like I said, well, now, you know, they want to really get into this, because again, it's like they said, it's this is like the whole scheme of evolutionary religion. So they need to really flesh out this ghost cult issue. So that's what we'll pick up on next time here. Let's take a moment, everyone.